I know this is the last panel session of the day, and I'm so glad you hung in there. I hope you have lots of books from the Boston Book Festival. And I'd like to take a moment to just thank everyone at the Boston Book Festival for all they've done to bring all this together. So, okay, so today we're going to be focusing on the complexities of war in fiction. We have three panelists. As some of you may know, Amy Waldman was not able to make it. That's quite unfortunate, but at the same time, many of the themes that are addressed in her novel will come up in our conversation today. So I'll forward some of that information to her. I'll introduce very quickly our panelists. I know you've read their bios that are in the directory. To my left is Abigail Rosewood. She's a fiction writer whose work has been published in numerous literary journals, and an excerpt from her novel, this beautiful book here, If I Had Two Lives, was awarded first place in the Writer's Workshop of Asheville Literary Fiction Contest. Abigail earned her MFA from Columbia. On the end, we have Maza Mengistu. Is an award-winning novelist and essayist. She was born in Addis Ababa and spent her childhood in, get this, Nigeria, Kenya, and the United States. So she's quite well-traveled. after her family fled the Ethiopian Revolution. She's written two novels. We'll be talking about her second one, which is called The Shadow King. She teaches creative writing at Queens College and at the Lewis Center for the Arts at Princeton. Tim Murphy, in the center here, is a novelist and journalist whose work, which focuses mostly on HIV and AIDS and LGBTQ issues, correct? Has appeared in many, many publications, including the New York Times. His novel, Christadora, was long listed for the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. His most recent book, which is what we're talking about today, Correspondence, has been very well received, as have all these novels if you've been following the reviews. So each writer is going to read a passage from their book so we get a sense of what the novels are like, and then we'll jump in with some questions. So Abigail? Sure.
A few weeks after I had moved in, I sat on the steps outside our building to wait for him. My new neighbor had a habit of walking up and down our block in the evening. He came out as expected, wearing a faded green corduroy jacket, which looked threadbare and not warm enough even on this mild winter day. He said hello to me, more welcoming than the usual New York manner that was pleasant but disinterested in further conversation. "Have you lived here long?" I asked. "For me, any time is a long time. Yesterday to today, today to tomorrow. Time passes faster for young people." "You're not as old as all that," I said. "No, I'm a newly grown fingernail, a dot in history." He bit off a hangnail on his thumb. He looked like a boy then. "What is it that you do?" "I make coffee, clean tables. I also launder." I got up and walked beside him. "Do you enjoy it?" "I'm good at latte art," I said. "What's that?" he asked, and then coughed into his palm. "You make little drawings by pouring milk over the espresso. If I'm not rushing, I can make fantasy creatures, like a jackalope. It's taken me years to perfect." He laughed and coughed some more. "Is that what you care about? You want to draw little hearts and swans on drinks that people will consume in less than 10 minutes or put a plastic lid over?" The laughter died in his throat. "If I don't focus on the details, I wouldn't know how to live. Isn't that what life is about? Just a bunch of trivial moments that you hope will accrue some kind of meaning at the end?" I looked at a squirrel grooming his tail on a low bush. It was so light that the leaves held it up just fine. "I want to believe that, I do. But people only remember the general, what history can capture, the records. You told me you were from Vietnam." I was glad to remember our brief encounter in the hallway the day I moved in. He took out a cigarette and lit it. "Want one?" I nodded. I didn't smoke, but wanted to please him. "Vietnam, yeah, something like that." He looked at me curiously. "When you told me where you were from last week, you were overly shy, like you couldn't place the country, or you couldn't place yourself in it. You weren't sure. You remind me of someone." He surprised me by grabbing the ends of my hair and held it in a fist. I felt his aggression and tried not to flinch or move away. He let go. "Who?" I asked. "People here still think Vietnam is a jungle, brown savages, an exotic Asian whore who you can't possess, but still satisfies all your sexual demands. It's burned into the American imagination. You can't change that. As soon as you say something different, you make them all that defensive or guilty or confused. Try telling them some other tales that don't fit their presumptions. Vietnam," he dropped his cigarette and crushed it with the toe of his shoe, "is a war, not a country. Anything besides is irrelevant." "Where are you from?" I said. I was shaking, though not from the cold. "You're not listening." "I am. It doesn't matter where I'm from. I'll always be the Gook from Apocalypse Now. And you, your history is irrelevant." Though I sensed that he wasn't trying to be unkind, I still reddened all the same. "I don't even know your name," I said. "My English name is, but if you spare me the confusion of hearing it, then I'll do the same for you." If he were my soldier, I should have known, but the sound of his voice wasn't familiar to me. I associated it with nothing. It was a thing on its own, untethered like the way he saw himself. "Don't you look back sometimes?" I asked. "Sure," I reminisce. "Just about every immigrant does. I have these flashes, standing in a wooden boat, pissing in a river, but it's like stumbling into somebody else's dream. You can't even think of boat or river in your mother's tongue. Everything you remember is shaped in a new language. All of a sudden, it isn't the same boat anymore, and I was never that boy. When you leave the old country at an age not young enough to get adopted into the new, and not old enough to know how to reject it, you become this mutant thing, between borders, between languages, between memories. He pressed his temples. "If you ask me, I think it's easier to reinvent and to retrace. You're not the only one, you know. Look at the city and its faces. You're not the only one with an ungraspable history." I'm gonna stop there.
Thank you.
I'll just set this up really fast. Correspondence is the story of Rita Khoury, who's a very ambitious young woman from an Irish, Arab, Boston area family like my own. You may not know it from my last name, but I actually am more Lebanese than Irish. And she's very ambitious, and you know, her goal in life is to become a foreign war correspondent. So she finally gets her big wish when the American Standard, the paper she's working for, which is a paper much like the Times or the Washington Post, posts her to Baghdad, to the Baghdad Bureau, shortly after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. And there, she is paired with a young man from a middle-class Baghdad family named Nabil al-Jumaili as her interpreter. Both Nabil and his cousin Asma are interpreters who've been hired by the paper at a very handsome sum by Iraqi standards, as was often the case. And as you may remember, a lot of Iraqis were employed by either the military or private contractors or by media as interpreters, and this was very lucrative work for them, and also became very dangerous work because to be associated with the U.S. at that time really had a target on your back. So I'm just going to read a little bit from. Rita arrives at the Bureau after the U.S.-led invasion has happened in about April of 2003, and Nabil and Asma have already been working in the Bureau, so this is the first time they meet. Inside, and this is from Nabil's point of view, inside the Bureau, as they'd renamed the villa, was buzzing as usual, its mix of about a dozen American, European, and Iraqi staffers propping their Thuraya satellite phones against their shoulders while they clicked and clacked at computers or scribbled into notebooks. Al Jazeera, BBC, and CNN played soundlessly on three different screens mounted on the wall, and Nasim, the tiny black-eyed, black-veiled widow, a friend of Mohsen's grandmother, who now lived in a small room in the villa and cooked and cleaned, moved around the large room with a cart serving tea, coffee, and bread and cheese, the morning routine. "Where's Asma?" Nabil asked Nasim as she handed him a small cup of her satisfyingly bitter coffee. "She's out with Master Rick at a press conference." He nodded in acknowledgement as he sipped. "How did you sleep, Nasim?" She shook her head dolefully. "Not well. I could hear bombs all night. Rat-tat-tat." She made the sound of gunfire. "Inshallah, my son visits me today. Inshallah." She trudged on with her cart. A young woman in a white collared shirt like a man's, jeans and Nikes, her dark curly hair pulled back in a sloppy bun, approached him, her arms outstretched, smiling. "You're Nabil?" she asked in Arabic. "I'm Rita. I've heard so much about you." He shook her hand. Her Arabic sounded good, he noted, her American accent noticeable but not egregious. Still, he replied in English. That was his job, after all. "Thank you," he said. "I've heard much about you, too." "How was the drive here today from Katimiya?" She now spoke English as well and focused on him very intensely as she talked, her eyes boring straight into his. She clutched her thuraya tightly, he noticed, as though she expected it to ring at any moment. "Not very bad," he said. Then he lowered his voice. "But I swear to you, I saw a dead body in the back of a van on 14th Ramadan Street. I saw the feet." Her eyes widened and her brow furrowed. You sure it wasn't just someone lying down?" "My father said that, and I said, no, not from the position of the feet." "Hmm," she sighed lightly. "Well, I wouldn't be surprised. How has your family been?" "We do not go out except for Asma and me and my mother to and from work. But despite that, we are okay. Alhamdulillah." He smiled slightly. "Alhamdulillah," he repeated. It was unusual to have a Westerner around who was at ease with Arabic. Most of them relied on interpreters who could tell a Westerner anything they wanted, and often did. They were both silent a moment. She did not avert her gaze, whose intent he could not exactly discern. Sympathetic, still sizing him up. Finally, he averted his own to her thuraya. "It works well?" "Hmm?" Then she saw him glance at the phone in her hand. "Oh, yes, well, it depends on where I am." "Of course, mine too." She nodded toward the back. Do you want to come to my desk and go over stuff? Do you need a minute to settle in? Rick and Asma are at a Marines press conference. Nassim told me." "Oh, okay, well, they should be back in a bit, assuming no issues come up on the way back." He nodded. "I follow you." Then he corrected himself. "I will follow you." She'd set up a desk in the corner with her laptop, notebooks, the usual mess of cords running all over the desk and along the floor to the outlets. The entire front room of the villa was a chaos of cords, and one had to walk carefully so as not to trip on them and bring down three desks worth of computers. He spied two pictures and frames on her desk. One was of what he assumed to be her very large family on a beach in America. He picked her out of the picture in a bathing suit. The other was of her and a young man, a good-looking ponytailed Arab man, arm in arm, with the sea and giant outcroppings in the background that he knew from pictures he'd seen were Beirut's Pigeon Rocks. She dragged a chair from him nearby and set it by her desk. He sat in it and faced her, his small coffee cup still in his hand. She took a swig from a large plastic bottle of water that wouldn't go over well at the Boston Book Festival, then smiled at him again. Not unkindly, he thought. He smiled back. "Is this your first time interpreting?" she asked. He nodded. "Asma encouraged me to do it." She smiled broadly. "Your cousin is a force of nature. Rick says she's one of the best interpreters he's ever worked with, and he's been doing this a long time." He grinned, proud of his cousin. "She has always been like that. She's talked Rick out of some bad pinches, a few angry crowds." Bad pinches. He'd never heard that before, but he more or less understood it from the context. He made a note of the phrase and nodded. "She is very persuasive." He glanced up at the TV screens. Al Jazeera was showing crowds of men in Sadr City furiously shouting down the American occupation. CNN was showing a clip of Justin Timberlake dancing at a concert. "Do you like interpreting?" she asked. I like it very much. I am happy now. I can utilize my education. But I wish only the country is more safe. It is a very scary time." She frowned and sighed. It is a very scary time. We're all a bit shocked at how badly the post-invasion has been handled." Nabil exhaled in relief. So at least she privately agreed that her country had screwed things up royally. "But," she continued, "we still have to get the best stories we can. And so, on that note, are you ready to hit the street with me? The fruit markets? New York wants a story on what life after the invasion is like for Baghdad women." Nabil couldn't suppress a slight derisive snort. "To hear that they are so free now? Iraq wasn't Saudi Arabia or Iran. No women had to cover themselves if they didn't want to." She smiled and nodded her head. "I know. Listen, we push back a lot on their ideas from New York, but sometimes we have to give them some version of what they want." Push back, Nabil noted. There was another one he hadn't heard before. He was going to learn a lot of terms, of new terms from this Rita. So he merely nodded. "Of course, it is as you wish. But please," she insisted, "I want your thoughts and your insights. I need them. Don't hold back with them." He smiled. "I will not." And she smiled back. "Good. Will you tell Ali to get the car?" I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coordinating all of us, Kat, really, and it's wonderful to be here. My novel is set in 1935 during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, but I'm going to read a short passage from the very, very beginning, the first page. It's the prologue, and the first it opens in 1974, and we have one of my main characters, Hirut, who was a soldier in 1935. She's looking back over the last 40 years. And then I will jump and read another relatively short passage from the perspective of an Italian soldier, and this is set during the war in 1935. She does not want to remember, but she is here, and memory is gathering bones. She has come by foot and by bus to Addis Ababa, across terrain she has chosen to forget for nearly 40 years. She is 2 days early, but she will wait for him, seated on the ground in this corner of the train station, the metal box on her lap, her back pressed against the wall, rigid as a sentinel. She has put on the dress she does not wear every day. Her hair is neatly braided and sleek, and she has been careful to hide the long scar that puckers at the base of her neck and trails over her shoulder like a broken necklace. In the box are his letters, le lettere. Ho sepolto le mie lettere e il mio segreto, Hirut, anche il tuo segreto, segreto, secret, mister. You must keep them for me until I see you again. Now go, vattene, hurry before they catch you. There are newspaper clippings with dates spanning the course of the war between her country and his. She knows he has arranged them from the start, 1935, to nearly the end, 1941. In the box are photographs of her, those he took on Fucelli's orders and labeled in his own neat handwriting, una bella ragazza, una soldata feroce, and those he took of his own free will, memento scavenged from the life of the frightened young woman she was in that prison, behind that barbed wire fence, trapped in terrifying nights that she could not free herself from. Inside the box are the many dead that insist on resurrection. She has traveled for 5 days to get to this place. She has pushed her way through checkpoints and nervous soldiers, past frightened villagers whispering of a coming revolution and violent student protests. She has watched while a parade of young women raising fists and rifles marched past the bus taking her to Bahardar. They stared at her, an aging woman in her long drab dress, as if they did not know those who came before them, as if this were the first time a woman carried a gun, as if the ground beneath their feet had not been won by some of the greatest fighters Ethiopia had ever known, women named Aster, Nardos, Abebech, Sadale, Aziza, Hanna, Maaza, Ainadis, Dabru, Balainesh, Maskaram, Nunnu, Tigist, Sahai, Beza, Saba, and a woman simply called the cook. Hirut murmured the names of those women as the students marched past, each utterance hurling her back in time until she was once again on ragged terrain, choking in fumes and gunpowder, suffocating in the pungent stench of poison. She was brought back to the bus, to the present, only after one old man grabbed her by the arm as he took a seat next to her. If Mussolini couldn't get rid of the emperor, what do these students think they're doing today? Hirut shook her head then. She shakes her head now. She has come this far to return this box, to rid herself of the horror that staggers back unbidden. She has come to give up the ghosts and drive them away. She has no time for questions. She has no time to correct an old man's pronunciation. One name always drags with it another. Nothing travels alone. And then I will move quickly to 1935. This is an Italian soldier, Ettore. It's the man that Hirut in 1974 is waiting to meet. And Ettore is a soldier in an army that will have a confrontation with Hirut's army. And in 1935, in this scene, he has just participated in an execution of an Ethiopian. Sorry, I'm going to move a little bit ahead. My page moved. Okay, if I don't find it, then we will go on. I'm sorry, my marker was moved. It's a writer's worst nightmare.
So bear with me.
This is, yeah, and I had made sure that I had it. And if it doesn't work, we'll
move on. No, take your time.
Thank you.
This is an important passage, which he's about to read about this soldier, and it does pertain to one of the questions that I'd like to
really?
Ask.
Because no, now the pressure is really on
a little pressure,
people.
Right? I can do it. I can ask it without
you
reading it.
You can ask it. I don't want to keep everybody waiting. And unfortunately, because this book just came out, I didn't memorize the page numbers.
Page numbers, right.
What if we just go
what,
on, and if I have
look,
it?
You look for it while we talk about while we go on with our first
question. Thank you, everyone.
First question.
You.
No, sorry about that. So the question I have, and this may seem like a really boring question, but it's actually quite relevant when you consider the three books that we have in front of us, is why is it so challenging for us to think of women as warriors, soldiers, reporters, survivors of wartime, and how does that concept of exclusion or just, you know, pushing women away play out in your novels? And I'm going to turn to Abigail first, because there's a very interesting line in her book. This is her story is one of a child who is placed in a military camp with her mother, and her mother has, you know, an unknown job, and so the child is really left on her own in this military camp. And at some point, the mother says to the young woman, "People ask me why I didn't focus on raising you, but they don't understand that our fate is bound up with the fate of our nation." So that's what I mean when I say survivors. And so perhaps Abigail can address that idea of how challenging it is for us to think about women in that role.
I think that we typically think of women more as survivors than as warriors, and one of a strong image that war leaves in its wake is that woman that had been raped. There, in many wars, women, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of women have been raped. And so that makes it more difficult to approach those women and see them as warriors, even though they are.
And that plays out in your book, because that is exactly what happens in, not in wartime, but in your book.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, I really struggle in terms of, like, the framework of talking about war, because for me, it's like, it's, you know, as a younger generation Vietnamese-American writing about something, even though I read that passage, I was kind of slammed in the middle of the book. What my goal ultimately is to humanize Vietnamese lives and to show that it's more complex than having been at war with America. Vietnam doesn't need to have been at war with America to have to exist. And so, you know, it's like, do I do that by, you know, do I address the elephant by saying, talking about the elephant, or do I, you know, avoid it altogether and just go on a different path and talk about other things about Vietnam to kind of, you know, create a complexity around that topic. So, yeah, it's a constant inner battle for me.
That's really good. It is a constant inner battle, and Tim, can you address that?
My constant inner battle?
No, not your personal one. Not today. We can do that another time. Maybe over drinks.
Yeah, right. address this?
The idea of women in war, why is it so challenging for us to think about women as warriors or reporters?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess probably for me, I'm more on the media side, right? Like,
the
I'm
reporters.
A journalist, you know, that's my bread and butter. That's
right.
My day job. And I mean, I guess it is. I mean, it's not challenging for me because I feel like I've worked for so many years.
How about your character, though, Rita? I mean, you know, why is it challenging for us to think of, you know, think of the things that happened to Rita in the book, why she was removed, how she was removed.
Right.
Yeah.
And does it relate to her being a woman?
Well, I'm not sure. You tell me.
No, I don't think what happened, I don't want to spoil. I don't think what happens to her relates to her being a woman. I think a paper like the New York Times would have handled a situation like that. You know, I just think that the public clamor that you know, that her misstep creates would probably play the same way. I mean, perhaps, I mean, if the reporter in question were like a star, you know, maybe not, but
well, she's fighting a battle, but it's not on the battlefield. You know, she's writing about war.
Yeah, I mean, I think the struggle she's engaged in is the struggle that all reporters engage in, especially when you're covering, you know, work, or you're covering things that are so wrong in a way, you know, where
right.
you can so clearly see the injustice. The struggle is to report it out, quote unquote, objectively, and she kind of cracks, you know. You know, even though I also think, you know, she's betrayed as well. I mean, she doesn't do it completely.
We shouldn't give it away.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, I don't like, I mean, she was an easy character for me to write because she reminds me of so many female journalists who I've worked with often abroad who were often so much savvier and more kind of, you know, foreign correspondent savvy than I was, and I sort of would marvel at their discipline. I mean, reporting abroad takes incredible discipline because you have your own kind of PTSD that you're, you know, but you also have to kind of provide for yourself. You have to stay alive, and you have to report. You know, so as you're constantly moving around, you know, and maneuvering, you also have to find that time to like sit down and file.
Right.
So, you know, I watched, you know, reporters, often women, do this with so much more discipline than I had. You know, I was like, are we done? Can we be done for the day? Can we just go have a drink? And, you know, and they'd be like, no, we're not done. You know, like, suck it up. We have 3 more hours to go. And so, you know, she wasn't a hard character, you know, as a really effective, tough female correspondent. She wasn't a hard character for me to envision because I think I was thinking of at least 4 or 5 women like her.
Okay, good. Yeah. So...
Well, in terms of why are we surprised about hearing of women in war, I think
particularly in your book.
Well, yeah. My book features women from Ethiopia who fought in the front lines against the Italian fascists as soldiers. And I think there are a few reasons, but I think the primary reason is that... the language of war has always been masculine. And it has been, we are so used to speaking in masculine terms of this that we don't even know what it's going to sound like if a woman begins to use her own language to describe war. Mm-hmm. And we have, even when women speak about war, they speak in masculine terms. And so I, you know, part of what I wanted to do in this book was shift that paradigm and really start breaking apart language and start looking at how does a woman see this? And I think one of the things that became inevitable when I started looking at this war through Hirut's perspective and through Aster and a few of the women who fought is that the women were well aware that they were both soldier and trophy in war, and that the war that they fought or were fighting, the war that women do fight even now is often a double war. It's a war perhaps for terrain and for land, but if you are caught, not only are you treated as a soldier, but you will be treated as a woman by these male soldiers. And there's a double war that a woman is always aware of, whether it's in any political conflict or any type of personal conflict, whether we're in a domestic situation or an international situation. I think women are constantly aware of that double language that exists in conflict. So I wanted to explore that, because when we talk about women in war, we're talking not about, maybe they represent a country, but their bodies are also seen as countries for the enemy combatant to conquer as trophies. And I wanted to explore that.
And you did. Thank you. Were you able to find the passage?
I was.
Okay. You wasn't? You were. You wasn't.
I did. I was like 2 pages over. Would you like to hear it?
I would very much like to hear it.
Okay. Thank you for your patience. This is from, this is 1935. We're now in the middle of war. This is my Italian character. I tell the story from both the Ethiopian side and the Italian side. This is after an execution. Now they are here in the bar that Fucelli reserved for them, a tiny tajbet in the corner of Dabark, nothing more than a single room with a corrugated tin roof, a series of chairs and a large unsteady table balanced on a dirt road covered with lemongrass and frayed rugs. It is the end of a long day. The prisoner still hangs from the tree. Ettore's camera still dangles from his neck. 2 exposed rolls of film still poke in his pocket against his leg. There is ample evidence that he is here, outside of Gondar, in this bar, far from home, and yet he cannot erase the image of his father stepping into the bar, a stack of photographs gripped in his hand while looking for answers. Ettore rubs his head. He has had several beers, and the waitress is bringing more, but it is only his father's voice that he hears. The cramped bar pulses with the commanding energy of Leo Navarra and his accented voice, the one he uses at home when there is no restraint in what he can say, when every word that comes from his mouth is exactly what he intends. Have you answered my question, my son? Do you know what you would see if you sat in a dark windowless bar in the middle of an African city and a girl were to walk toward you with a bottle of beer? What would you see, Ettore, if you turned in your seat to observe Mario and the others beckoning this waitress who was moving toward them in her native dress and lowered eyes? Is the body in shadow or in light? Remember, son, you are not home. There is no poetry in this place. There is no honorable stare that happens between these walls. Son, you who are here in this bar crammed full of soldiers, drilling this girl with their eyes while a young man hangs from a tree, what do you have to say? I say the eye will hold in itself the image of a luminous body better than that of a shadowed object. I say, Father, the eye has the power to keep what it sees. The eye is greedy. The eye will always seek and devour that illumined figure made visible by predatory light. Fofi says, did you see him? Did you see the way he was smiling even when I pointed my gun at him from the ground? Fofi says, did you see the way he tried to act tough and stare at me even after they tightened the rope? Fofi says, did you get a picture of me next to his feet, Ettore? Can we call you Foto? Everyone laughs, Mario the loudest, and Ettore nods and he laughs and raises his camera and points it at Fofi and he says, I'm going to shoot you now. And it is funny, Father, it is a joke. And so we laugh and we spend that night around that table telling jokes and miming faces so we do not hear the fresh cries coming from the villagers, their voices a ripple extending from the horizon to the ends of the earth. Because, Father, this is war. Is this war? Fofi asks as Mario buys him another beer. This is not even war, Giulio says, but he is not laughing. And Ettore orders another beer, and they watch the waitress balancing the tray of beers while dodging hands. And when she comes to their table, she glances at the camera, and she says, no photo. And Fofi laughs again and points at Ettore and says, no photo. And they drink their beer while Giulio keeps standing up and going to the door and checking outside. And I was glad on that day, Father. I was happy. Thank you.
Okay, that's a great, thank you. That's a really, really good, a very important passage too, and it leads me to my next question, which I'm hoping everybody can answer in maybe one line or two lines, and it has to do with something that Maza tweeted, and I know, now she's going, oh no. And the tweet is, I'm fascinated by the terrain between what's visible and what remains invisible, but may still be discernible. I wanted this book to consider the concept of photography and more broadly the concept of the image and complicate it by thinking of it as a weapon of war. So in each of these books, there's a weapon of war, and in particular in Maza's book, it might be photography, in Tim's book, it might be the some of the news reports, and in Abigail's book, it might be, and maybe you can tell me the idea of dispossession and being a refugee, that very image.
An immigrant,
yes, sorry.
I'm interested in that concept of image because in a broad sense, I feel like war is kind of an archetype. Like it, you know, the fact that veterans have PTSD and commit suicides, and you know, to this day, is a proof that war continues. And so the war begins at the moment that the state manages to convince its citizens of who the enemy is. Mm-hmm. It's not at the moment of the declaration. Well, that's, you know, it begins in the imagination. And so images are very, very powerful to begin war. And I think war is, you know, inherently political, but its goal is always to perpetuate itself. And, you know, if any goods that comes out of it are kind of accidental. That's my kind
that's
of
great.
My stand.
Tim?
What's the question again?
Let's go over to Maza, and maybe and then we'll come back to you.
Okay.
I put a camera in the hands of my main Italian character, Ettore, because I know that Mussolini was well aware of photography as a weapon in war. But mm-hmm. I was also wondering, what does it do to a person to point the camera at somebody else and understand that there is a very deliberate and false narrative that's being crafted? We have seen the way that the camera has shaped our understanding of people who are different from us. And it still happens today. We can look at the way that Trayvon Martin was depicted right after his murder and those first photographs that first came compared to the images that his parents then would put out into the world. The camera has been used against people of color. It has been used to help excuse subjugation and colonialization and violence. And so I was well aware of that, but what I didn't know was what did it feel like to be the one holding that camera? Mm. And what does it do to a person to be taking those photographs? And so I wanted to imagine Ettore with that camera, because as much as those images that we look at seem to be a reflection of the person, the subject of that, those photographs reveal a lot more about the photographer than they do about who's standing in front of the lens. And so that's one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book.
Thank you. Why don't we have people line up for questions, if there are any, or you can just stay in your seat and just and let us know. Does anyone have a question? Yes. There's a mic behind you. You might want to go back there so everyone can hear. There, thank you.
I was just wondering, Shadow King, how do you live with that world that you write about? I mean, it was amazing, but I assume that you didn't write it in a week or two. And there was a lot of research. How do you kind of immerse yourself in that and yet kind of go on with...
With life?
With life. And you'll all... You know, could answer that too, but I mean, that was particularly what blew me away with that. It was just like, oh my Lord, just how relentless the stories are. I mean, amazing. Everybody should read that book.
I'm really interested to hear also what the other two panelists have to say about this. I know that writing for me is, it's a very immersive, I throw myself into it. It took almost a decade to write this book. So if you can imagine, I was living with these characters every day. But writing is also, it's also a discipline. And as much as it is a something about emotion, for me it's also a vehicle for exploring very specific and very, very complicated questions about what it means to be a human being in conflict, or not. The research that I was doing tended to reveal really horrible histories. It was sometimes eerie to be sitting there researching fascism as the 2016 elections are coming up, but the one thing, looking at the headlines from 1935 and then seeing their echoes in now, the one thing that keeps coming back to me, which I think made this work less devastating than it could have been, was the fact that I kept finding these glimmers of incredible courage and dignity and resistance, which is always going to exist. And that was very much the case in this book. Even when people didn't agree, their acts of resistance were astonishing. And I think that's happening even now. We'll hear about it later, thanks to correspondents and writers and those people who write their own stories.
Other questions?
Wait, but I want to hear.
Oh, do you want us to speak to that as well?
Yeah.
So the question was sort of, how do you write about hard stuff and, like, go on with your life?
I mean, it's because, you know, the stories are so immersive. And,
Well, you know, it's funny that you said that took... I feel like for a fairly fat book, like, I wrote it fast because... I wrote it fast because I was immersing myself in so much research, talking to, you know, a lot of it was anything I could find online, you know, but it was also like talking to a lot of Iraqis as well, talking to vets, talking to service members. And it's like, I wanted to weave it all into the story while it was fresh, you know? So I actually wrote fast. Like, a lot of time I'd be writing one chapter, one section, the part set in Iraq, while I was researching that I knew the next chapter was gonna be set in Damascus. So I would just be like doing all the, you know, and then once I had it, I didn't wanna just sit on it, you know? I wanted to kind of roll it right into the story. So, you know, I would say that, it was, you know, it was hard, but also I was very aware that, you know, it's a weird thing to, like, a third of the book is set in Iraq, and I haven't been, and I would have liked to, I mean, I love the whole region, and I'm, you know, I spend a lot of time in Lebanon particularly, which is in the throes of a revolution right now, this very weekend apparently. Go, revolution. But, you know, I think for me what is sort of hard is the kind of appropriative quality, you know, like there are scenes in here that play out almost in real time, you know, that are about, you know, that are about literally the aftermath of like a U.S. bunker buster falling accidentally like on a neighborhood, and really what that looks like, you know. So, you know, that's hard. That's hard to write. It's painful to write, and it's also kind of raises questions for me of like, why are you even attempting to narrate something that you didn't live through or that you weren't close to, you know, like. Kind of really raised issues for me of like thinking about, why are you obsessed with this? You know, like, is it morbid? Is this some sort of like, you know, misery porn on your part? I mean, I think what drove me was that, going back to the power of images, is that like, it's remarkable when you think that like, no media, except for maybe some Democracy Now, ever shows us what the effects of our violence look like on the other end. You don't see you don't see a little boy with like whose legs are across the street, or like a little girl whose head is across the street. And that is what we as the United States, that's what we continue to do, you know? And I think that what drove the book for me was this idea of the United States as this sort of dome that we live under. You know, it's like we live in the Death Star, basically, and we don't even know it, you know? Like, we are so dissociated from, you know, the drones we drop and the bombs we drop, and that those are just the most extreme examples of the way that we sort of like have this, you know, we have our military thumb all over the world. So, you know, what I wanted to do with the book was I wanted to start the book very much in the U.S., you know, in a family that would feel very cozy and familiar, and then flip the narrative on the head, and suddenly you're almost in like the Baghdad version of that same family, you know. So I wanted to try to create the feeling of when bad things happen to that family, like you feel it because you're actually with them, like you've actually been with them in their living room, seeing what that family looked like and what the family dynamics were 6 months before their lives were literally blown apart. So, you know, I mean, I just think it's unconscionable that we don't see, I don't know if anyone was in the session with Elliot Ackerman, you know, who's a brilliant writer about war and has served, you know, in the military and stuff, but you know, we were just, he was just talking about our myopia, like it's almost, it's by design that we as Americans are cut off from what we do in the world because, you know, and the lack of a draft has contributed to that. I mean, everything is engineered toward making us as oblivious to and dissociated from our actions in the world as possible, which thus perpetuates them.
Yeah. Thank you.
I guess, like, as a writer and artist, I consider, you know, darkness kind of a gift. And in writing this novel, which is in many ways very personal to me with many autobiographical elements, you know, a good amount of psychosis, a good amount of creativity, I think it's just my own exploration to try to understand, like, what happened. And I think I didn't really realize that I suffer at all until I have written it, and then I feel like, oh, I kind of have PTSD a little bit, but I didn't realize that I felt anything at all because for a long time I felt nothing. So I think working on a book is my way of humanizing myself. Yeah.
Thank you. Do we have other questions? I see somebody in the back.
Thank you so much for... Is this on?
No, can't hear it.
You promise?
There we go.
Okay. Thank you so much for your writing, all of you. And what I'm curious, and you alluded to it a little bit at just speaking, what came out of the exercise for each of you?
The exercise of writing.
I guess for me, it's like I realized like I have that the sense of for tragedy is actually a gift, and I think I see tragedy in other people as their gift. That what you have been through, what you have experienced, is kind of like, you know, your soul journey. And knowledge. And so through writing, I begin to accept all those parts of myself, including the very, very seemingly psychopathic ones, traits.
What came out of the book? Well, I mean, I think for me, I felt like I felt a good sense, you know, when I literally wrote the last page, you know, the page of the book, that I had written the book I wanted to write, which was, I wanted to write a book that was partly about Arabs in the United States. You know, like Arabs have been, particularly Syrians, Lebanese have been in the U.S. going back to the mid-late 19th century, and it's rare, and particularly in this region, you know, it's like very, we've really woven into the kind of like Yankee, Irish culture, you know, in very interesting ways, and you know, and I just wanted to portray that. And also, I've been, you know, for many years, I've just been obsessed with the Iraq War. You know, I've just, and I can't believe that, you know, with every passing year, well, it's funny. I mean, as we continue to live, even right now, the repercussions of it. But I feel like, you know, no one ever really You know, so few Americans really saw narratively what that war looked like on the other side, on the receiving end. So, you know, for me, the challenge, the kind of Rubik's Cube I was trying to fit together with the book was, how would you weave together a story about this kind of long-standing Arab-American family that's become very assimilated into Americanness and whiteness, you know, with this thing that happened, you know, halfway around the world? How would those two things fit together? And so the book for me, the challenge was how to do that. And so, you know, I guess just to your point, at the end of the book, I felt like, you know, regardless of what anyone else thought about it, I'd done it. And that was a good feeling.
I guess I'll keep this brief, but I think one of the challenges I set for myself in this book was to really move in the skin of an Italian fascist and try to think about what that person put words in his mouth and put thoughts in his head that would be realistic if he were to look at me. And that was a difficult thing. And initially, I wasn't quite sure that I could do it with any level of honesty. But I think by the end of the book, I said, "Yeah, I can pretend to be a fascist." So that was a big challenge, though. That was hard.
Hmm. So, do we have another question?
For Mr. Murphy. How do you feel about the rehabilitation of George W. Bush? Oh. Now he's treated like a...
Why don't we schedule because, a whole new although, hour as much to talk
as,
about that?
As much as we hate Trump, at least he hasn't killed people. Where George W. started the Iraqi war for psychiatric reasons.
Yeah.
And now he's being rehabilitated. Celebrities talk about him. Even Democrats say, we wish we had George Bush again.
Yeah.
And... he's even painting pictures of the people, our people, who were wounded and crippled due to his war.
Yeah. Well, I think George W. Bush and all of them are war criminals, and I don't really care how nice a guy he is. You know, and I have limited, quite frankly, I'm torn, you know, because it's like, I feel like I've sort of reached the end of my own rope with, do I have time, do I have 20 seconds?
Just one second, because I think what we're really dealing with here, I'm going to jump in and then I'll let you go back. What we're really dealing with here is the idea of rage, that we all feel that somebody like George Bush can be where he is now. And that brings us to the idea of rage, the rage that we feel in reading these books, which is what I believe that our questioner is tapping into, the anger that we feel and that the characters feel.
Well, as citizens, are we all fascists that we live in our society? And this goes on. We pay taxes and say, well, we're innocent, we don't do it. But yet, if you don't fight it and really fight it, what are you but a contending?
So that would be one thing that somebody would take away from reading your book. That rage?
Yeah. What I was trying to say to answer your question was, I feel that there is value in, you know, a lot of people are saying, what about kindness and civility? And, you know, and I feel torn right now in this moment because I feel that there is real, I feel like it's a really dangerous thing when you take a whole half of the U.S. population and you say they're monsters, you know. But to see him rehabilitated in that way, you know, just because we have a president now that is more of a monster on his face is disheartening. And I think it, you know, again, I just think it speaks to, I think, you know, most of our media is designed to dissociate us from what we do in the world. And that's why only a little bit over 10 years later, we can look at George Bush and go, oh, what a nice guy, you know? Because, I mean, we really were on the receiving end of, you know, and there was not even half a rationale for that war. I mean, we utterly destroyed not just a country, but a whole swath of that region for no, there wasn't even like a crumb of a rationale.
They wanted to show his daddy that he was going to protect them, right?
That was part of his rationale, I think, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how does that relate to your book? I'll give you a minute. Well, I mean, rationale for the war, for the Italians coming into Ethiopia.
Let me say that listening to him, to Tim and this question, the Italians have gotten away with this war in Ethiopia. They have not been charged with the war crimes that they should have been charged with. They haven't even apologized for the concentration camps and the massacres and all of this. The one reason, one of the reasons that they have not done, they haven't been required and have not stepped forward to do that is that they have not only convinced the world, but they have convinced themselves, and this is where it connects to Bush, that of all the other evils that were going on in the world, they were the least evil of the evil. They were not Nazis. Mm. And the minute you start using Nazis as a threshold for evil and not an extreme, then you're in trouble. But they've managed to do that. And the saying in Italy is, Italiani la brava gente, Italians are decent people. And this is what you'll hear again and again. They're too disorganized to actually have a war. They care more about pasta and wine than they actually do about killing people. And nobody really looks at what they actually did in Libya and Eritrea, Somalia and Ethiopia. And this is what happens with George Bush and this rehabilitation with him painting. And the media, the way the media will latch onto that. But nobody's going to put those paintings up against photographs of Abu Ghraib. And nobody's going to hold that up next to the, you know, whatever he proved from Rumsfeld. So we don't want to remain uncomfortable, and rage is an uncomfortable emotion. Feeling. But you know what? We need to do it. Like, we need to be angry and stay angry. Because, as you know, I'm on Twitter a lot. I follow a few. I don't follow them, but I do find them, a few of the Republicans. And the minute that they can quote Bible verses and never once talk about children that are dying in cages or that they've separated from their families, but they can quote a proverb, screw that. You know, we need to be angry and come back at them.
Like, so, yeah. Well, our time is up, and I want to thank everybody for coming today. There's a book signing in the back of the room, and I encourage you to... Oh, okay, books for purchase in the back of the room, and the signing is then outside. I encourage you to purchase books, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.